the opportunity to be here this afternoon to join in what has already been a very stimulating discussion, and I'm sure we'll continue after our panel. I want to spend a little bit of time picking up and building on some of the points that Simon made towards the end of his remarks, namely, major political pictures. Geopolitics is the substrata of everything else. And while we look at political outlooks and we look at economic outlooks, we need to recognize that there is a deeper driver behind all of that, which is encapsulated by geopolitics or geoeconomics. Now, you know, for a number of decades, we have been speaking about our strategic environment, shifting as economic weight realigns strategic relationships. But today it seems to me that rather than meet the settling point that many of us had perhaps hoped for, this fluidity may be leading us instead to a tipping point. And at the heart of that, I think, is the churn in the US-China relationship to which Simon referred. I just want to spend a bit of time talking about where that's heading, how it's been managed and mismanaged, and what it means for Australia, because the last four decades, which has been the four decades of the China growth story, have been extraordinarily good for Australia and for the region more broadly. We would not be in 2017 or uncorrected economic growth if it hadn't been for the China story. It seems to me that those four decades are now beginning to look like our salad days in terms of the relationship with China. And what lies ahead looks more complicated at best for Australia and gloomy at worst. And at the heart of this is that the China of Xi Jinping, on which most of our policies have rested, is not the China of Deng Xiaoping. Rather, our policies have rested on the China of Deng Xiaoping, not the China of Xi Jinping. Now, China will ultimately define its own strategic settling point. It's not going to be forced into anyone else's view of what it should do or what it should become. But it's also clear now, in a way that it probably hasn't been for some time, that what China wants to become is the predominant power in Asia, or the predominant power in the Indo-Pacific. Currency these days than it has in the past. And why should that be a concern for a country like Australia? I think to answer that question, you really have to look at the way in which interests and values intersect in our foreign policies. Because the international behavior of a state is shaped by many factors, its geography, its culture, its history, but it is also closely linked to the character of its political system. And China's political system is ultimately a matter for China, and Australia has neither the capacity nor the right to insist that it follows a particular path. But if China aspires to be the predominant power in the Indo-Pacific, then by definition, it would make it the single most important shaper of the region's strategic culture and the region's influence. And so whether it's a democracy or a one-party state, actually matters a great deal. For Australia, a democratic China becoming the predominant power effectively displacing the United States and the Indo-Pacific is a very different proposition to an authoritarian China occupying such a position. Now, we all want to see China succeed. We all want to see China play a constructive role in the region and the world. But we also want to see a strategic system in the Pacific, which is anchored in the rule of law and which recognizes the stability that U.S. strategic engagement has brought to the region. Our starting point for the future is that Asia is going to be a much more multipolar region. China has already eclipsed the U.S. as the world's largest economy. If you measure it by purchasing power parity, you get a lot of debates as to whether that is the central measure for comparing economies. But it probably isn't too far away from also being the world's largest power measured in market exchange rates. Now, the GDP per capita of China is still being weighted below that of the United States. And that will have an impact on China's priorities, and it will have an impact on the way in which domestic and international challenges are put together in this. The U.S. focus is a global focus. The U.S. is a genuinely global power. And that dilutes the attention that it can give to any particular region at any particular time. China has global interests, but its geopolitical priority is squarely in Asia. And that means that its geography as a resident Asian power and the intensity of its economic connections to other countries in the region give it a certain strategic leverage in Asia. China is a country and a civilization which understands power and its sense of place has been shaped by the many centuries in which it was a little kingdom. And this historical memory, in my view, is likely to play a very important role in the way in which China relates to regional states. I think we're now entering a potentially dangerous period in U.S.-China relations, and Simon spoke a bit about that. On one side, the voices of containment are getting louder, the case for engagement is losing ground, and some speak openly of a new Cold War. China, for its part, seems to be moving away from economic reform and from giving the market a larger role in the allocation of resources. And this is something which I don't think receives enough attention. You know, whether or not the US and China reach a trade deal by 1 March is a third order issue compared with the decision of Xi Jinping to turn his back on structural economic reform in China. Because while you can understand the short-term political imperatives behind that judgment, in the longer term, it creates a huge dilemma for China's leadership, because the pact between the party and the people is that the party keeps the monopoly on political power as long as it delivers rising living standards to the Chinese population. The more you defer structural economic reform, the harder it is to keep growing that economy in a way which translates into rising living standards. And the harder that gets, the weaker that compact between the leadership and the people looks. Absence of political structural economic reform in China is something which has very deep consequences, not just for China, but obviously for countries like Australia, which have so much riding on it. So on top of Xi Jinping's decisions on abolishing the term unit for leadership, we see party control now reaching into all aspects of the economy. Cyber attacks are becoming more sophisticated. Hide and buy has been replaced with a sense that China's time has come. Now, there's nothing new about the United States being determined to hang on to its strategic primacy. I think that's intrinsic to the American view of itself. And America First is just one, perhaps exaggerated, example of the very anchored belief in the United States that they are and need to remain the world's greatest power. But what is new is the suggestion that this can be achieved by blocking or thwarting China. Now, I don't think there's any sensible alternative to engaging China, because containing China in a way that we contained the Soviet Union during the Cold War is a policy dead end. I mean, China is just too enmeshed in the international system and too important to the economy of the region to be contained in that classic Soviet sense. And the notion that global technology supply chains can be divided into a China-led system and a US-led system is, in my view, both economic and geopolitical folly. Now, the US is absolutely right to call China to account, but it would be a mistake for the United States to cling to primacy by thwarting China. Those of us who value U.S. leadership and want to see it retained want the United States to hold its position by lifting its game, not spoiling China's. The U.S. should play to its very considerable strengths in economic depth and flexibility, technology, research, alliances, and values to buttress its standing. Strategy anchored in supporting China is a more dangerous course than a country which already looks to redeem itself from a century of humiliation does not need its worst fears confirmed. In the end, China's rise needs to be managed and not frustrated. It needs to be balanced and not contained. And constructing that balance and anchoring it in the new strategic equilibrium in the Indo-Pacific is actually the big challenge and the big project for our region over the next 15, 20, 30 years. We need to shape a balance of power which finds room for China, but which also advances the interests of the region's democracy. Democracy is just the fact that the reality that most countries in the region are basically uncomfortable with China becoming the predominant strategic power. They don't want to contain China, but they do want to balance China, indeed to constrain its behavior in certain areas. But how will that be done? Should it be a constructed or an organic balance in which countries will be part of it, and will their objectives we can already see the de facto balance along these lines developing through the shared desire of the US and Japan, India and Australia to balance China, each has its own geopolitical and historical reasons for doing so. Incidentally, the non-democratic China is not the primary driver in many of those cases. Not going to be a classic balance of power building. It's more likely to be organic and not orchestrated. And it's likely to be an evolving balance on both sides. Russia for now lines up with China because they both have an interest in putting the winds of the United States. Neither support a liberal international order. But for the most part, this is an opportunistic partnership between China and Russia, masking a fundamental strategic suspicion of each other. Nevertheless, it's a partnership with a shelf life at least as long as its authoritarian systems. But the emerging strategic balance in our region is unlikely to rest on two balancing aligned systems, partly because China doesn't do a that many partners.
has other ways of exerting influence, most notably the gravitational pull of its economic opportunity. So Australia, how Southeast Asia responds to this is going to be fundamentally important. I think ASEAN is a grouping designed to sit on the sidelines and not be forced to make a choice. Some individual ASEAN countries, I think, will find themselves on the other side of the China balance, but many important ones are going to be pulled more and more into China's orbit as their economic interests determine their final position. So a long-held hope, I think, that ASEAN as a grouping, for example, would remain neutral but lean towards the West, where Indonesia's success is going to be fundamental because Indonesia is primarily a base setter strategically in the region. The two Asian powers, with an absolutely unambiguous commitment to balancing China by Japan and India, for each, China is the reference point of their strategic compass. Geography and history pull them to the other side of the China balance, and this creates of the strategic bond between them, which they are both moving fast to develop. India is in the midst of finding a major geopolitical repositioning as it discards its old non-aligned movement rhetoric and starts pursuing a more hard-headed national interest-based policy and strengthening its own indigenous defence capability. The primary driver of India's strategy firm attachment to strategic autonomy and to preserving maximum freedom of action. India is not about to become an ally of the US or anyone else. It will be guided by its own interests as it builds strategic ties with a range of countries, including many with which Australia and other Western countries have limited strategic confidence. But that said, India will still be basically a supporter of the rules-based international system, and that's important from the Australian perspective. Japan is no longer willing to contract out its strategic positioning to the United States. It's carving out a more independent role and is determined to use its economic heft, and we would be unwise to underestimate Japan's economic heft to leverage its strategic interests. More willing to push out the boundaries of its constitutional limits for the protection of power. None of the subject can be seen as Japan being on the verge of abandoning its alliance with the United States. Indeed, the larger China looms in the consciousness of Japan, the more persuaded that it become the remain of the value of the US alliance. And if a break in that alliance comes, it will only be lost faith in the US commitment to Japan's security, and not even the fickleness of President Trump is likely to lead to that somewhat grim conclusion. Let me just make two more points about this balance of power. The first is that it would be a mistake to try and construct it as a formal capital A alliance of democracies, as a number of people have suggested. Avoiding an alliance, I think, is a much better fit with the strategic preferences of countries such as India and Indonesia, neither of which wish to become allies of the US or anyone else. And an organic balancing, as opposed to an alliance, is much more in keeping with the strategic framing of the Indo-Pacific than a formal arrangement. But an organic balancing does leave room for particular initiatives, including the so-called Quad, which brings together the US, Japan, China, and India. This was abandoned by the Rudd government because of Chinese concerns, but one principle we in Australia need to be firm on is not to allow any country a right of veto over our strategic policy. the seat of every generation that is poised on the threshold of something new and different. But when we look out at our international environment today, it's hard to avoid the sense that the ground is indeed shifting beneath our feet. To adapt a title from the late Tom Wolfe, we seem to be facing the bonfire of certainty. So many of the supporting pillars of the post-Cold War world seem less secure from an Australian perspective. US strategic predominance is narrowing, even fading, protectionism is on the rise, the liberal international order is under stress and arguably terminal. In many developed democracies, identity politics is overshadowing older ideological fault lines, and illiberal democracy and authoritarian approaches are attracting more support than they ever deserve. So we're currently in the middle of a transition in international relations, and that is probably the worst time to put it into perspective. Some of what we're seeing today are exaggerations or aberrations which are unlikely to become enduring trends, but others go to the bedrock of global geoeconomics, deciding which is which is far from easy. For example, it'll be a mistake to see President Trump as an aberration and assume that US policy will return to its form after his departure. I think one of the unfortunate consequences of Trump derangement syndrome is that it makes it harder for us to think about how much of Trump will survive this presidency. But equally, it's unlikely that all of his policies will survive his departure. It's more likely than not, to take just one example, that the value of US alliances will be restored to a central position in US policy in a post-Trump world. And with China, we may well see a tactical shift in China's approach as it recalibrates how far and how fast it can proceed with its more assertive foreign policy. All of these, of course, raise very large challenges for Australia and make the navigation, in particular, of the Australia-China relationship more difficult. The last point I want to make is that the issues aren't being covered, which are, if you like, subterranean trends. I mean, they are like waves. We can see them on the horizon, but we don't know exactly when they will break and in what pattern they will reach our shores. And we cannot, order them back, but we can prepare for them and think through what form we want them to take. They cannot be resisted, but they can be shaped. And that is what the Berlin Wall is ultimately most about.